Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to the Rahalastapa Book Club number 3. We are doing a weekly, well, not always weekly, we'll see. Extra podcast where we talk to various authors and just about their books, just as a lovely, and because we should read more books. I should read more books. This is making me read more books or listen to more books. And so should you. And so please buy this book. It's very good. It's called Catch Your Breath. It's by Ed Patrick, who joins me from an undisclosed location. Where are you, Ed?
Undisclosed in my house in Oxford. I'm sat in a location, the safest location away from animals. There's several animals that could jeopardize this podcast, so I've decided to isolate myself as much as possible.
Yes, you have several pets, which I have learned from your book, which I did in two stints. I had COVID and was stuck in my room, and the book was there, and I hadn't read it for you. You'd sent it to me very kindly, so I read about the first half of it, and then I got the audio book. Last week or the week before, and listened to that first half again and the second half. So I've completed the entire thing. And there's an extra chapter on the audiobook for audiophiles. He discussed me, but you can have another book. Tell me, let's hear it from you. How would you sum up your book? What is the book about?
So in a short version, it's a funny and honest memoir about becoming an anaesthetist, which a lot of people have heard the word anaesthetist, but don't really know what it is. It's kind of this magical world. And it's partly because if you ever meet an anaesthetist, you're unconscious pretty soon after you've met them. So it's understandable that not a lot of people understand what's going on. So it was intriguing to tell people and talk about the sort of dark arts behind it. But then also over the last couple of years, it brought into focus just where anaesthetists are in the hospital as well. So all that sort of encompassed, basically.
And so did you get the book deal, or did you have the idea to write the book before COVID, or was it COVID and the situation of COVID that made you think this story now needs to be told, or what was the order of the...
I think the order of things was I always kept notes of things. I always thought anaesthetics was fascinating. I loved it. And I always thought that it was something to really talk to people about and people didn't really know much about. But when the pandemic hit, as with everyone, all comedy outlets, because comedy was always an outlet for me, you know, balancing the comedy and the medicine things. But when all the gigs shut down, when everything shut down, writing then became an outlet. So I thought, right, I'm going to try and put this down on paper and just started going with it that way. So it came, it did get stimulated from the lockdown and the pandemic, and that really sort of focused the energy in towards it.
Yeah, well, it does give it an extra... I mean, you say near the beginning, you know, if you're listening to this to get a history of the pandemic, you kind of think that's quite... That seems quite a pompous assertion at the beginning. And then listen to it, but go, oh no, fair enough. it's because actually, obviously the experience of the NHS staff, and particularly in anaesthetics, is sort of crucial to you know the whole treatment, isn't it? And so the first half of the book, or the first maybe a little bit more than the first half of the book, is about your training and you're being a student, being a quite seemingly quite incompetent student, or making lots of mistakes, which are very funny. So there's lots of laughs, but obviously there's some serious stuff, and there's obviously an element of people dying as well in this book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's medicine, so there's always going to be sort of light and dark with that. But yeah, absolutely. There's that whole fish out of water experience of becoming. Becoming a medical student, coming into the medical world, because essentially we are just other average people that have happened to just walk into that line of things. But once you get into the title of medicine or doctor, people seem to look at you as if you've got some sort of extra about you. But actually, you know, behind the eyes and stuff, we're still, you know, very much a human. We don't know everything. We still we use Google. You know, it's not a little bit more insightful, but you know, we're still just human like that.
Yeah, well, there's a funny bit when you are presented with your first dead body, and you can't understand why this shaven head man on the slab has no penis, and think you're very clever to ask about it, which is an enjoyable part.
Yes, this is unfortunately. Based on truth. So we were essentially it was the first day of medical school, and they tried to get you used to things. So it's sort of, you know, it's quite a daunting experience. So they show you various labs and the hospital. And then obviously one of the big things is an anatomy lab. So not many people at this stage have seen a dead body in real life, for want of a better term. But essentially, to get us used to it, they laid out an entire full body for us to do that. And we were all in our sort of lab coats walking around like it's the worst game of Cluedo, just sort of all pointing and nodding. But then myself and someone else noticed that this bald elderly man had the genitals removed, and I couldn't work out why. Yeah. So we went and said to the head of the medical school, we just said, look, listen, I don't know if there's a sensitive reason, but why have the penis and testicles been removed? And it was one of those moments where you felt like, I am really actually quite mature, because it seems like quite a silly question, but actually you've got to ask questions to learn, and I will, you know, be looked upon greatly for this. And the head of the medical school kind of took a double glance at the door and then back at us, and then just suddenly said, well, that's a female. We just shaved the head. I don't know why you didn't think about that before you asked the question. And you could see the anxiety in his face that I'd already got into medical school at this point.
But you sort of forget that obviously doctors are pretty young when they start. And so, you know, there's a chance. And I can understand why you made that mistake. And you might well have seen naked bodies before, but that might be, if that was me, that would be almost the first naked person I'd seen, certainly like properly laid out in front of me. So you know, you forget about that. And I think it's, you know, it's a very good indication of how, you know, you go through all the, how much you have to go through to become a doctor. So there's all your training, and then you're working in the GPs, and again, you know, various funny and tragic stories from that. But then also the decisions, the choices you have to make throughout. I mean, I think like some people would maybe not even realize that someone who the anesthetic the anesthetist is a doctor. You know, I think people might think, oh, that's a guy who's, you know, learned how to do this somewhere probably in a couple of weeks, and then that's all he does. But obviously anesthetists are fully trained doctors as well.
Yeah, I mean, you're not too far off, actually. There is a point where you do start doing anaesthetics, and a little while after doing it, you are basically, you know, let off leash and then off you go, sort of thing. But in the in the UK, you are essentially, you finish medical school and you are a doctor, but you're a trainee doctor where you do these 3 or 4 month rotations doing different things. And just as you've got the hang of something, you then move off to something else. And then you're suddenly faced with this decision making of you've got to choose like a final sort of career path at some point. And so there's over 90 different specialties, so you're never going to get to choose all of them. This is compared to the USA, where basically you finish medical school and you go into the specialty you choose, basically. But there's lots of other reasons why people choose things over there, because obviously, you know, people are picking things based on, you know, how much they might get paid, for instance, and stuff like that. But I chose essentially anaesthetics, which is quite a high, medicine's high stakes, but it's probably one of the more high stakes things there is. So, you know, if things go wrong, they go quite wrong. You have to act quite quickly. But essentially, you're basically then started training into doing some anaesthetics. And after you've done it for a couple of months, they basically say, right, that's it. You're good enough. You can go off and do some anaesthetics on your own. And then suddenly you find yourself overnight just in the hospital sort of manning it and just waiting for things to go off.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's an incredible having had to use the NHS last year and to use an anaesthetics, it's an incredibly important job, and you know, and you're essentially sort of killing all of your patients and then bringing hopefully most of them back to life again, which not all of them sadly, but hopefully most of them will come around again.
Yeah, exactly. So we do things that generally would get you reported to the GMC or various medical or legal bodies if you did it, because we just disrupt the physiology on purpose. Yeah. And if you went to your GP and they stopped you breathing, they would be like, well, you know, that's not really looked upon quite well, you know, probably frowned upon. Whereas, yeah, we do that on purpose. So we might make blood pressure drop lower than, you know, most people. We might can stop people breathing, alter the heart rate and things like that. But that's actually par for the course. That's what you aim to do. So you start off and you'll get other doctors that come in and see what's happening in anaesthetics, and they'll look at the monitors and they'll be like, oh my God, if I saw that on the ward, I'd be absolutely shitting myself, essentially. But that's just what we're used to. So Anita's got this kind of very relaxed vibe, and it's because you're sort of dealing with the extremes of physiology. And also, one of the coolest things about it is the drugs. I mean, no one can deny that. It's one of the coolest things. We use a whole wide range of drugs, which we could talk about as well. But it's got this whole sort of magic. And there's no set formula. Like, each anaesthetist you meet might have a different way of doing things, but each of them is right. So everyone's sort of like a chef with all these different sort of drugs. And they'll pick and choose. And you might work with one anaesthetist one day and they'll tell you to do things one way, and then you'll go to another and then they'll do things completely differently. So it keeps you on your toes. But
it was my experience of having general anaesthetic, and I was offered a spinal anaesthetic, which I just couldn't understand why, in my circumstance where I was having a body part removed that was quite, that I didn't really want to see being removed, it didn't seem much of a choice to me. So I definitely wanted to be out, but it was so lovely to be knocked out and then just come around again. So it really felt like that's what death is. It really felt like I've died. There's no soul, because there was nothing there. It wasn't like my soul was going, what are we doing for this next hour? There was no dreams. And then you just, you know, come around and again, you're awake. But it was I found it quite reassuring. It felt like if that was the way you died, that would be quite a nice way to die. If you didn't wake up, you wouldn't know about it. But if you can do that, you're not tempted just to do that. You know, just, it's like traveling in time, isn't it? Are you not just tempted to take some of it home with you and do it yourself?
I think you're not tempted to kill people, is what I was saying.
No, well, are you tempted to kill? Well, we'll get onto that later. Are you not tempted? You know, I would just, if I knew how to do it, I suppose you need to be awake, right, to wake them up again, to wake yourself up.
Well, if you remember, like Michael Jackson's obviously the person who used one of the most commonly used anaesthetic agents, something called propofol, to keep him unconscious. But he has a whole cocktail of other things. The problem is that when you stop breathing like he did, there's no one there to sort of take over that sort of stuff. So that's the issue. And that's what happens with all the drugs that we use in anaesthetics. All like in like America, where there's, you know, where there was the opioid crisis and the whole fentanyl thing, that's the issue. It's such a potent drug. It stops you breathing to the point that you end up respiratory arrest. So that's the issue. You run the risk of that.
Yeah.
But funnily enough, you say
it's worth it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's worth. There is a problem. I mean, there is a problem because people in, you know, positions of anaesthesia have been, you know, exposed to being able to abuse drugs, or, you know, like you said, you know, there's a protocol for things being left over, but, you know, what if things go missing and things like that? It's totally not unheard of. I mean, even darker than that is there are stories of people using some anaesthetic drugs as murder weapons, and then like trying to cover it up, especially things like the muscle relaxants, which is like I find fascinating, the muscle relaxants. So
yeah, you mentioned that in your book, but then you get caught if you're going to do it. It's good you make sure you don't get caught. If you're going to do that and then burn the house down, you'll get caught, because then there wouldn't be any carbon monoxide or something in their bloodstream that they wouldn't be breathing in if you die. So if you're already relaxed and dead, you can't do that. So it's good. There's some good tips for murderers in there.
I will say one thing about the drugs, which I also found fascinating, that people might not realise, is that, you know, when you get a pack of paracetamol or something and you open up and you've got the instructions and everything in there and it tells you.
Yeah.
So for every single drug, including anaesthetics, there is a patient information leaflet, including for the muscle relaxants. So muscle relaxants, they paralyse you. And it says stuff like, before you take this medicine, have a chat with your doctor. And it's like, why would you be taking? Why would you be paralysing yourself? And it's like, and then there's like questions like, is it safe for children? It is safe for children. But have a chat with doctors before, like.
Well, you know, it's amazing stuff. I think that choosing the discipline thing is interesting. Again, I'm writing a book about my own experience on the other end of all of this, and going through COVID as well. So it was quite interesting to read your book from your point of view. But the I was wondering, when they sent me the dimensions of my tumor / testicle that had been removed, I kind of wondered, whose job is that to measure that, and how do they measure it? But also, you know, who decided, is that a punishment that you say you've got to go and measure the cancerous balls, or does someone go, oh, can that be my job?
It might be something people volunteer for. I'm not quite sure, but there's definitely. I mean, I'm sure they would have had a large ruler at the side available for that.
I hope they wiped it off afterwards. It was big.
It was. Did you get to keep it, or did what?
No, no. Well, I never. That's sort of like throughout I sort of wished I'd asked even, but I think you're not allowed. I don't think you're, unless it's for religious reasons. I don't think you can have it back.
People don't. I mean, there obviously are some things that you can keep, and people, you know, things like teeth and stuff that kids can have back. And you've seen stories of people having their gallstones or something like that. So I'm not quite sure. I guess it depends how enthusiastic the request process is there, because I'm sure that once, if you really, really wanted your testicle back and you'd written several letters saying this is my body, I'm sure that.
I mean, I think you could argue, definitely. I mean, I sort of want, but every point that I could ask about it, and, you know, in a way, as a comedian who thought I might do stuff about this and I might experience, I should have had the ball to ask for my ball. But, you know, when the woman, the doctor who told me that I was going to have it taken off seemed more upset about it than I did. And so it didn't feel like I could go, oh, I'm doing Taskmaster. I thought that might be quite a good price for Taskmaster. Can I have it back? So it felt too serious a situation, weirdly, even though I found most of it quite funny. It was obviously slightly unsettling and upsetting in places, but I have to say again, you know, it was interesting that reading your book in conjunction. I guess I was sort of lucky that this all happened in the early part of 2021 rather than in the early part of 2020, where I'd have been left stewing for several months waiting. I was amazed how quick and efficient and cheerful and wonderful the NHS were. Pretty much everyone was ready with a joke, or just, you know, not taking things too seriously. It was amazing. And to think what you'd all been through.
Yeah.
In that previous 12 months.
And also that sort of thing, you know, people have missed doing as well. I mean, one of the things for me, when we get to the second part of the book, is that obviously we were taken over to intensive care. So just a bit of background is that intensive care and anaesthetics used to be joined together. But years ago they split up, and which was fine. But now intensive care actually still do need anaesthetists to come across. And when the pandemic hit, we had to go. So all the sort of anaesthetics disappeared. So doing operations like that, yours, would just... wasn't even on the cards. So, you know, to go back to doing anaesthetics, it was a complete mind, complete relief for the mind. I didn't quite realise, but you know how you realise some things in hindsight, that actually you are quite down and quite depressed and like you actually don't enjoy what you're doing, you know, spending these 13-hour days in intensive care. I lost that identity of doing anaesthetics. And so going back, you know, I totally see where you say everyone was really happy. Yeah. Jolly. It's just like, oh my goodness, this is what we wanted to be doing. We want to be, you know, putting people to sleep and being able to wake them up and send them home and let them have their stuff done. So yeah, it's, I think it's, it was much of a relief for the patients, as like I said, for people like you going and having it done.
Yeah. And it is great to hear, you know, like I think I sort of had a little scare this year and had to go and have another scan. And luckily it turned out to everything was fine. But having experienced both of those, where it's not fine, where I thought it was going to be fine and it wasn't, then I thought it might not be fine and it was fine. You know, it's the guy doing the scan was going, oh, yeah, and it's great to be able to tell people that, you know, there's nothing wrong or this is just a cyst and there's nothing to worry about, whatever. It's it's good to see the human side of the medical stuff. Not that you're not seen as being human, but you're seen as professionals. But it must be nice, as horrible as it is and as draining as it is, to have experienced all the unpleasant and the tragic sort of stories. It's lovely to see you sort of writing about the things that work and when you get it right and how happy, you know, how personally happy you are for the person who's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's it. That's totally what we missed over the last couple of years. And that's what we worry about, is that, you know, if we end up in this constant cycle of like, you know, if there's another variant or something like that, and then it takes over, you know, you just suddenly dilute all that being able to do it, you know, go and do the job you really want to do.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
And so, like, in terms of getting the book published, did you take the sort of idea to a publisher, or was a publisher sort of, obviously, as I said in one of my Rahelastapas, you know, there's the success of the Adam Kay book must A, be very exciting for you to think, well, this book, could my book do the same? Which I hope it can, because it's a different take on it, and but it's equally, you know, important in terms of understanding how the NHS works and what amazing work they did. But did they come to you? Did you pitch it to lots of publishers, or was it, what was the process of getting it actually published like?
It was surprisingly, the rate determining step was me getting a proposal together, basically, as it right. was. So I knew what I was going to do, and I got it together. And yes, I was thinking, obviously, you know, it's like with medicine and like different genres of anything, there's always different stories to tell. So like you said, with Adams, he's got, you know, very obstetric, you know, in medicine, there's lots of different stories, just like there's lots of different crime stories. So I thought anaesthetics was actually one of those things to really tell people about as well. So that was the basis of it. And then obviously the pandemic came as well. So I sort of got this proposal together, which was going to tie them both in like the book does. And I sent it to an agent. I think I sent it to a couple of agents, and then one came back immediately. Like, when I say immediately, within like 10 minutes. Right. and then came back 2 hours later after they'd read it, and they were just like, right, this is great. Should we talk on Monday? So then, obviously with the agent, and then it was 2 weeks later, it had been taken up as a preempt, right. which had, So for me, it's a brand new process for me, like the whole book thing, you know, going through it and this whole procession. So I was sort of oblivious on this little boat riding past going, all right, is this normal? Is this what normally happens? And so I obviously realized how lucky and how smooth that process was. But I think the key thing was just actually doing it and braving it. You know, it took a long time to hit that send button on the email. You know, when you've got it loaded up, it's almost actually like, oh, because you do feel like sometimes when you're doing this, you've got sort of a one shot with people, because if you get into too much of a discussion, I think, you know, you sort of lost that pizzazz about it. So you kind of want to present what you've got for you. So luckily I'd had some conversations beforehand about our books before pandemic. So I kind of had an idea building up to that of what a proposal would look like. And so once I got that ready, that was basically it and sent off.
Yeah, and it's sort of, I guess there's an element of timing, and you know, if it's often publishers are looking for a specific type of thing or are not looking, the danger is when you're sending in a book and then, I think this just happened to my wife, who had an idea for maybe a book or a TV show. If you send it to someone and they've already got something, even a little bit similar or whatever, even if yours is great, that can be the problem. But if you send it, that's a pretty incredible bit of I don't think I've ever heard of anyone getting a book published in tennis. Although maybe there was when I did my original emergency questions book, it was a bit like that I went in for a meeting and the guy said, yeah, we'd love to have the podcast, we'll do it, you know, which I'd never experienced in a meeting. Usually there's a bit of, you know, well, yes, we'll think about it and have to talk about it. Basically, it was pretty much walking out of that meeting. But then I went to another meeting, arguably sort of a more important one, and that was just like the worst meeting I'd ever had, which was for a TV company. So I had this thing like, oh, I'm on a roll, this could be it, I'll get a book and I get a TV deal. And then the TV meeting was the absolute worst TV meeting I've ever had. So, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I think just like, because it's so hard to be a writer, right? And it's, yeah. So you just have to keep persisting and you might get a bit of luck early on or you might get a bit of luck a few years down the line. How did you, given that it is so hard writing a book and given that you are a working doctor, anaesthetist, how did you get the time to, how did you actually physically write?
Yeah, well, write the book? That's a good question. I mean, I'm just thinking back to the whole process because it was such a blur, but it must have been over the course of a couple of months, that whole process. And then we started writing and then the deadline was pretty, they wanted to get it out in 2021 as a hardback, but then the paperback obviously coming out this year. And I think I found out that in the mornings, I'm not a morning person at all. I can't tell you how much of not a morning person, but once I'm up, I'm more productive than anything. I could do more in 2 hours in the morning than I would do in 6 hours for the rest of the day, but I'm hardly awake. And I don't know why, but I suddenly managed to focus that energy into getting up to be able to do that. And then occasionally I just get into a stream of consciousness for those sort of moments. And then I just tried to balance it around the shifts as well. So I had like, I remember drawing up a spreadsheet on Excel, obviously, here's a deadline, here's what I've got to do. And then my fiance looked at it and said, so this is, you're expecting to write all this in this period of time. This is not going to happen. You need to do this. So I was kept sane by, you know, someone else from the outside looking in saying, you know, when you say, I can write an Edinburgh show in the next 2 days, you know, and get it all sort of, it was a bit like that at the start. And then, just managed to gradually focus and just keep plugging away. And I think, again, it's about writing. It's about just getting it done and then worrying about it afterwards. I think that there was so much anxiety about putting something out there or sending something off, and like there was with the proposal. And sometimes you reach chapters where you're just not quite sure how you want it to go or do. And in the end, it was just getting something down on paper, which you can then change or delete or do anything later, but then it's there, you know, you can get it done and then change it afterwards was the main thing.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And it is really difficult. I think the more you write, the harder it becomes to just write, but it's absolutely the key to it, to just write nonsense, just write rubbish and then come back to, or just try and get a little bit down of what you're trying to do. And I think it's interesting that having constricted time can just focus.
Yeah.
I mean, nearly always when I write something, I do a lot in the last week, you know, so I do a big, I probably do a quarter of the work in the final week, but you know, you've been thinking about it all the time. But I think, but I found this time as well, that, you know, I was just picking up 2 hours here and there, just like you. I wasn't saving people's lives in the interim though, unfortunately. And although I stopped a bloke getting run over by a bike yesterday.
Oh, so, there you go.
I'm sort of a hero as well. But yeah, it's, you know, it is focusing. And I suppose wanting to do it, I think it's interesting you say that you've been keeping notes the whole time. Because again, with my book, I do a daily blog, which I would advise any writer to do, just in terms of you don't have to put it on the internet. It's just a diary, just in terms of getting used to writing, but also as an aid memoir. And, you know, I never knew there'd be a book in last year. And certainly when I started the year, the stuff I was writing, I didn't think this would be in a book. But I would have absolutely forgotten everything that happened. Or yeah. Certainly the stuff around, maybe not the main drive of, you know, what it was like for those things to happen to me. But all these little instances that, with the same with your book, and it's clear you've done the same. Because you've got these little colourful stories that sometimes about your personal life, sometimes about the job. So you were sort of keeping a diary.
Yeah,
throughout, which must have been very useful.
Yes, but the key thing was it wasn't always like lots of paragraphs of diary or anything like that. Sometimes no. It was just sort of a couple of words, and that's all you needed just to jog the memory, just to say that something had happened. And I think that was the key thing. You were able to, because you do think that something so stark happens in your day-to-day life, and you're like, I'll remember this, I won't forget it, and then you do forget it. Again, it's just, like in comedy, when you have that moment, if you don't write something down, you'll just forget. It's like, what was that thing?
Yeah.
It's amazing how life can just pass you by then in that sense. But yeah, write everything down, definitely.
I mean, I think it's just good to, you know, get the practice of writing as well. I think I have all the things I've done, just in terms of creating stand-up material as well, which it was never the intention of the blog. The blog was just a way of warming up for writing, which is why it's called Warming Up, but it never really was that. But I think out of all the things I've done, that was probably the most useful thing. And, you know, sometimes what you're doing is going to be no use or not interesting or you'll never use again. But you only need, you know, one thing every month or so to hit or to give you an idea of something. So that's very interesting. And did you find it easy to write it? Did you enjoy writing it, or was it a struggle to write it?
I did enjoy writing it. And definitely looking back, it's one of those things where you've got to try and enjoy the journey, because sometimes it's not enjoyable when you're stuck in those ruts. Yeah. But there were points where, you know, you could see, you know, starts and ends, and then there was middle bits you needed to work on. You know, there's lots of drafts of things you do. And actually, when I think about it, there's lots of things I wrote that probably didn't make it into the book, didn't make it into the book. Then there's other bits that you put to the side, and other ideas you have. So everything can come into play. So for instance, the bonus chapter, which on the audiobook was something that got brought together from other things that have been written about on the site as well. I think I'm interested in what your thoughts are this as well, is that I am deadline driven for these sort of things. But authors are, you know, well known to have to pass their deadlines and get extensions and things like that.
I sort of feel like, I think with comedy shows, that's how it works, because there is a deadline, because there's the first before, or there's a performance, you know, even just like a preview, you can't just go on and go, I haven't got anything. You have to at least have something you can dick around with in the preview. So I think in terms of writing comedy shows, I'm absolutely driven by deadlines. But because I know, and even my editor, you know, because I was writing something else, and it was, you know, and she also, having worked with me, she knows that I can come up with it, and she knows my first draft is pretty good. You know, like the last book, The Problem with Men, which was the book I did a couple of years ago, which was a short book, but basically for the first time in my life, the editor came back and said, yeah, that's good. we'll put that out. There's like, well, you know, there's a couple of typos and style things we have to change, but you've got it. Because it was a short book and I worked very hard on, you know, I had to be very concise with everything. So I think she knows that it will be done. So I was 6 weeks late on my original deadline, but she was very cool about it until this last week, because I've just literally finished the first draft, so it's not over yet. But like about a week ago, she said, we will be needing something soon, even though I'd said it'd be a couple more months. And so, you know, so then when I had that, I thought, yeah, great. Well, that's a good incentive to get it done. So I am really deadline driven, but that sort of slightly, you know, fluid deadline that I think editors put a deadline in knowing their writers are going to be 6 weeks late. So,
so that was it. With the proposal, I did. I definitely set myself a deadline, probably the first ever deadline I've managed to set myself in terms of be worried to make this deadline in a self-imposed deadline. But after that, I certainly felt the editor's deadline. But it made me wonder because I didn't have, sort of 2 years to write. And you know how some authors obviously will get a deal to, you know, a book that will be released in 2024, 25. I'm interested to know like how that dynamic works because, you know, if you've got 2 or 3 years, you know, if you're a crammer, which I can't deny being, do you get to the final sort of 2 months and then suddenly you're in a cabin in Canada or something? Just,
I mean, yeah, I would much, but you know, I did, I suppose I have written the book in, aside from having written the blogs, I didn't really start it till November or December. So I've written it in 4 months, you know, so I think, you know, you can, I think it's very, it's, I think 2 years to write a book is, unless you're writing, you know, a novel is that thick and has lots of research and stuff. You know, I think to write a memoir, and I've done a bit of research and stuff because I've kind of gone around the subject a bit, so it's not just my story. But if you're writing a memoir, I don't think it should really take you all that long because, because if you've worked out, once you've worked out what it's going to be, unless you're just going to make stuff up, which is interesting in your book because obviously you've had to change details and names. And at the beginning, it says any similarity to anyone living or dead is coincidental, which it surely can't be entirely. I know you've got to say that, but however, you've got to change it, but it's obviously got to be truthful as well.
Yeah, I've already had a anaesthetic consultant contact me saying, "Ed, I read your book, really enjoyed it. Can I just ask, am I this doctor?" And I was like, I can't possibly comment on the reality.
Well, there's one guy you don't like working with. He must be able to work out who he is because it's not.
there's
not many options.
It's obviously an amalgamation of experiences. But I think you're right. I knew where the book was going, where it was going to land, where it was going to end. And also, I think as much as the deadline as well, it really was the only thing I could do creatively. I mean, obviously, there was all the online gigs and things like that. But in terms of like creative outlet, that was really it. So that was coming home and then sort of decompressing by writing, by getting it all out, essentially. And the second half of the book definitely felt it. And even when I go back and read bits now, I've almost forgotten about that. It's not that I've forgotten, but I'm like, oh, yes, I do remember actually that moment or that, you know, how intense it was or, you know, how soul-destroying or how how difficult. But also the moments of sort of like, you know, the dark humour moments as well that we all had together as well. So it's, it was definitely a release, I think, as well.
I mean, it sort of surprised me how little of the book was the pandemic, but I suppose the experience was just this amorphous, like a never-ending thing of basically the same thing happening over and over again. There can't be the same amount of time to get to know people because they were basically everyone you were seeing was already, not either passed out or not able to talk. But you do get that, you know, because you're still talking about it. 12 months or so, maybe a bit longer, aren't you, of the pandemic that you were working with, you know, times when it was suddenly getting a bit better and then getting worse again. But, you know, you really, I think you don't need any more because you get the idea.
it's an interesting thing you touch on there is that, you know, as in an anaesthetist or just generally you're used to seeing patients, getting to know them, building that relationship, like you, when you had your operation, you know, you met your anaesthetist, knew what they're going to do, you felt comfortable, put them off sleep, wake them up, and those moments of interaction became shorter and smaller and smaller, and you could give no guarantees as well, which was also really difficult. So, you know, one of the devastating things about the disease when it was pre-vaccine and when we didn't have any when people were really unwell with it, is that you could have what we would say is really low oxygen, but still function. So normally, if someone has such a low oxygen reading on the saturations, they might be confused or they might, you know, not be fully with it, and you can just go. But people would be fully lucid and then ask you, "Is this the right thing? You know, are we doing the right thing here?" You basically don't have much time. You have to say, essentially, well, this is the last thing we can do. And, you know, I can't guarantee what will happen, which was an absolutely insane position to be in, having been someone who's so used to doing things and seeing immediate results. So someone's got low oxygen, I'll give them 100% oxygen, the levels come up, you know, low blood pressure, give them from fluids and things like that. Everything we did took so long to have any sort of increase on their sort of state, whereas any drops off the cliff were really sharp as well. So you lost all the rapport with the people, and then also you felt like you lost your ability to really sort of make any sort of impactful thing. It was very devastating in that sense too. And then, as you said, we just kind of this relief of everything coming off and then back in it again and then off again. And then we're like, vaccine's great. Everyone's going to love the vaccines. Who's not going to like a vaccine? Everyone will love them. I did an interview for Sky News about the vaccines, and I just got asked what would you say to people who are still sort of hesitant about it? And I just explained that, you know, when you don't, when you come into a hospital with COVID, and if you need to come into intensive care, you have to give you a whole cocktail of drugs that have all these side effects. None of which we can guarantee or won't guarantee. And this is just to keep you alive. So, you know, having a vaccine was obviously a good idea. Now, I didn't think a doctor thinking vaccines were a good idea was a particularly hot take. I kind of thought that was just par for the course. Yeah. But after that, there was a clip that went out and it just went viral. And then next thing I know, I'm getting, Instagram messages, or getting Twitter feeds, or getting people are emailing me to say, like, to say that it's all... it's all rubbish. People comparing me to, someone called me a Nazi. You know, and it was just sort of oh my God.
Class Barbie.
Yeah, exactly. And so you've gone through all of this and you just think, this has been like one of the best things ever in terms of stopping people coming to hospital. How could we possibly have gone back into...
Well, the world's gone. The world has gone mad, which we've been discussing quite a few of the podcasts. So
it has.
How crazy the world is, but that's and as a you've been working as a doctor and in medicine and as a comedian for a good long time. I did a show with you, didn't I?
Yeah,
a few years ago when you did your was it a podcast or was it just a live? It was just a live show, was it?
That was the very, very first incarnation of the Comedian Surgery podcast, which I run, which is available, where we interview people about their health stories and experiences.
Yeah.
It was yourself and Ivo Graham and me, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, of course it was. Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, it seems to be two, mostly doctors who become comedians stop being doctors. Or become sort of funny doctors, but they're still work. You know, it must be very hard to manage both of those very demanding careers.
It is in a couple of ways. One is just logistics, because you know if you're doing gigs and things like that, you've got to try and preempt rotas along with gigs and stuff like that, and you've got to you're forever at the mercy in the NHS of whoever is coordinating your rota and things like that. So it's always one person you've got to, and it's a real gamble as to who that is and how sympathetic they'll be. I think that if it was, 30 years ago, it would be more impossible to do this kind of thing now that I'm doing now, because medicine very much was, all your life should be focused on medicine. Nothing should come in the way of it and stuff like that. And I definitely felt that when I was in medical school as well. I never talked about doing comedy when I was doing medicine. So I did like first couple of years a doctor, and I would never tell people what I was doing in the evening. So like, I remember I was doing a placement, and then the consultant said, "Oh, where are you off to this evening?" I was like, "Oh, I'm just not doing nothing really." And I was doing some corporate show in London with Jimmy Carr sort of thing. And it was like very exciting. I was so excited, but I couldn't tell anyone about it. And then I ended up chatting to another, someone else who spotted that I'd had this on a CV, and basically said, why don't you talk about this more? You know, why don't you do more about this? And then that's when it really started getting more confident in terms of, let's do both of these. So then I realized that the NHS has softened that. And there's a couple of reasons. One is because they realize that people have got to have lives outside of medicine. And two is because they're just going to lose people otherwise. So you have to have this decompression or something else you do. A lot of anaesthetists are cyclists, and that's not really what floats my boat. But for me, it was always comedy and medicine has always been the two things that I've just balanced off each other.
Yeah, it's tricky. Do you get a lot of... Harry Hill always used to say, and I know instances, not personally, of like comedians sort of just getting their cocks out and saying, what's wrong with that? Did you get a lot of that as a result of hanging around with comedians and knowing about medicine?
You do, yeah. I can't remember who it was, but someone... You get asked just really basic questions.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who it was, but someone asked me about... just that they hadn't opened their bowels for a few days. And what did I recommend? And I was like, have you had the coffee? And they were like, no, I don't drink coffee. And they came to it was a weekend gig somewhere. And so they came the next night and they were like, I haven't stopped going since I had like two lattes. So you get all those. And obviously you get all the skin stuff as well. But as an anaesthetist, it's quite good that you don't have to worry about that anymore.
Yeah.
But you do get people asking you little tidbits in here. Why not? I mean, it's difficult getting an appointment these days, so you might as well just take the most of it, you know.
Double useful. And yeah, the audiobook as well, briefly mentioned, did you? It's nice. I always love it when the author does the audiobook, which seems to be happening most of the time now, not always, but obviously as a comedian, that was never going to be an issue.
Is that not common then, well, in the past? Or?
I mean, I think for comedians it's usual, but like for, you know, Richard Osman's books are read by... that fantastic actress whose name's, I've forgotten her name, but she's fantastic. I want to say Leslie Manville, but I think that's wrong. But yeah, so sometimes people don't read their own books, which I think Osman could do. I think he's just too busy to do it.
Is this his Thursday Murder Club that's read?
Yeah, yeah,
oh,
yeah.
So I've just been reading that, and I've been reading it in his voice that I hear on.
Well, she's very good. I wonder if I can quickly find out what her name is, but she's very good. Probably better than Osman would be, because actually, I suppose because it's, you know, because it's characters and stuff in it that let me see if I can find it on here. And I've messed everything up.
Chapter 14.
Oh, look, I've started your book. It's you. You've started off.
I'll tell you what, I didn't realise how difficult it was to say the word anaesthetist until I had to say it about 140 times.
There's a few times I think, does he know how to say his own job, this guy? And I'm not sure that's
the guy who was doing the recording was just... He was very nice about it. And what happened was I'd say something and thought I'd get away with it. And I'd be like four words later and he'd be like, let's just take that again, Ed, shall we?
It's a hard word to say, as I've found. I'm going to say it. This will tell us. So come on, get on with it. Get on with it.
The Man Who Died Twice by Richard Osman. Read by Leslie Manville.
Oh, I was right.
Ah.
Read by Leslie Manville. So she's very good. But did you enjoy the process of doing the audiobook? It's quite a long... Yours isn't too long a book, actually, is it?
No.
How long did it take? Is it 2 days?
To read it? It was a... Yeah, so it's reading... No, I think it took 3 or 4 days, actually.
Did it? Okay, yeah.
It was... But it was great fun doing it. There was... The script you have is slightly different to the one you get in the book. And so when I was reading it, there was a couple of times when I saw what I thought was mistakes and then there would be a panic and I'd be like, oh my goodness. And then realize it didn't actually correlate what was in the final version of the script book. It was just written because, you know, sometimes it's just when you're reading something, it's better to sort of change it slightly. That was what the editors had done. But I thought the whole process was great and also just gave you a chance to really... sort of go over it and enjoy it, really, isn't it? Because you've spent so much. It's a celebration almost in a way.
Well, you sort of don't do, you know, and that's what I find about doing your final draft. It's very hard to actually fully concentrate and not just, you know, oh, I've read this page 1,000 times. I've just skipped through this page. You know, it's actually quite hard to force yourself. I've asked my editor if I can do the audiobook like quite early on. As soon as we've got it finished, I want to do the audiobook. So that I can then go, look, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. Because you always spot mistakes or just sloppy writing in the, you know, that you wish could change. And it's very rare that, because they usually do it right at the end. It's very rare you've got time to go, can we change this in the book? And they go, we can change it. I think we managed to do it for both of mine, actually, just about. But I mean, I'm going to try and do it early next time.
That's exactly what I was talking about, where I was like, I had no idea what goes on. So I was picking up stuff. I was panicking in like last few weeks and picking up, and we'd missed an somewhere. And then ended up getting an email just saying, you know, we send this off to a proofreader before we. And I was like, what's a proofreader? I have no idea what that is. And it's like, they look for stuff like this. And I was like, all right, okay, that's fine then.
But there's always stuff that gets missed. Whenever you open your book the first time, you'll find a mistake. But also it's even more. It's just like, oh, I've used that same word in 2 sentences in a row and no one's picked that up, and proofreaders often don't because they're not looking for that, or there's just sloppy writing, or just, you know, I can write that sentence a bit better. And that's the, you know, with a book, you're never going to quite perfect it. You could always keep going back over, you know, I've probably gone over the first half of my book 12 or 13 times, and every time I'll just tinker with something. You would never you would never just get to the point where going, I'm absolutely happy with this. But the great thing about a book, unlike a comedy show, is that you sort of do get to the point where it's over.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say was, compared with a comedy show as well, is that I didn't realise what a lovely sort of long process it is in a way. So that the book comes out and, you know, whereas your show's done. Whereas with a book, obviously, it takes people time to read. And so there's this, you know, sort of almost influx over time of people telling you they've just read the book. Yes. So it's lovely to see that enthusiasm. And then also you've got, like you said, you've got the audio book. You know, if it's a hardback like this, we've got the paperback coming out. And then there's another big celebration of it there. And, you know, this is a time after a time when it was handed in, you know, last year sometime. So to be able to really celebrate something like that actually feels really special in that way as well.
And it is nice, you know, it is nice to have something. And, you know, I think this is, it genuinely is the kind of book that someone's going to pick up in 50 years time to get a view of what was, you know, because it's not, I'm sure there'll be lots of people writing about this from all sides, but it will be, it is an historic event and it will be something that people, well, hopefully it won't become just the regular, oh, here comes another one. Hopefully like in 50 years time, and if we're here in 50 years time, that hopefully it'll be like the Spanish flu. Oh, let's find out what happened there. So it's it is a resource, and so that's the nice thing about books, that they're there for a while, and maybe for after you've gone. So it's it's very interesting. Look, I'm going to let you go, but the book is Catch Your Breath. It's out in hardback at the moment. It'll be out in it's coming out in May in paperback.
It's coming out April the 28th.
Well, perfect. That's very soon.
It is very, very soon. Yes.
Yeah. So go. Maybe wait for the paperback. Do you want them to wait for the paperback?
Pre-order the paperback. You can pre-order it.
Pre-order the paperback. What a good idea. It's very good. It's a nice read. You can probably read it in,
I've had
a couple of sittings.
Yeah, I've had people tell me that they've read it in 2 days, or they've read it, started in the morning and managed it in the evening, which is unbelievable.
When I was down with COVID, I read it for a day and got halfway through. So I think that's exactly right. It bore a second viewing as well. So there we go. It was good to come back to it. So Catch Your Breath by Ed Patrick. Thank you, Ed, for chatting with us about it.
Thank you for having me.
That's my pleasure. I'd also like to thank Chris Evans, not that one, who has set everything up. He's a very nice man. We'll be back next week with more. I think we're doing another one next week, but we'll be back soon with another Rahela Stubber book.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for fantastic downloads and books, and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, RichardHerring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts.
Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It'll make me feel sad.